Chapter 15. Revenge. It was just after 7 p.m., March 1st, 1973, and darkness had fallen in Khartoum, Sudan. Outside the Saudi Arabian embassy compound, small groups of diplomats stood around saying goodbye to one another after a successful cocktail party. The American guests of honor were George Kurt Moore, the chargé d'affaires, and Cleo A. Noel Jr., the ambassador. They were getting ready to head over to the presidential palace to have dinner with President Gafar Namiri of Sudan and Haile Selassie, the emperor of Ethiopia, when all hell broke loose. A Land Rover screeched to a halt in front of the embassy's plate glass doors, and out leapt 8 masked gunmen, each with a dagger attached to his belt. One of the gunmen shot an embassy guard in the head, another raked a wall with automatic machine gun fire. A bullet tore into the leg of Belgian chargé d'affaires Guy Eade, and he fell to the ground bleeding. Ambassador Noel got hit in the ankle, and he, too, went down. "Run, run, run for your lives!" shouted Jan Bertens, the Dutch chargé d'affaires, the only diplomat to make it to the street before the terrorists locked the gates and took everyone hostage. Inside a reception hall, each diplomat was forced to identify himself by nationality. The terrorists released all but 3, Moore, Noel, and Eid. The gunmen identified themselves as members of the Palestinian terrorist organization Black September. Founded in 1963, it had since become the most feared terrorist organization in the world. Through local journalists, the terrorists made their demands known. They wanted Sirhan Sirhan, the Palestinian who'd assassinated Senator Robert Kennedy in 1968, freed from a California jail. And they wanted 100 Black September operatives released from prisons in Israel and Jordan. At the White House, President Nixon was notified of the hostage situation by Henry Kissinger. The men sat down and discussed what to do next. 26 hours later, the president held a news conference. "The Sudanese government is working on the problem," Nixon said. He said of the hostages, "We will do everything that we can to get them released, but will not pay blackmail." The policy, which was not written down, and which Nixon had made up 3 months earlier during a hostage scenario in Haiti, would play a profoundly consequential role in the decades to come. Just a few hours after hearing this news, the Black September terrorists in Khartoum received a phone call from their commanding officer in Beirut. "Since President Nixon wasn't going to agree to the terrorist demands," the commander said, "the American diplomats were useless and the gunmen should finish them off." In Khartoum, Robert E. Fritz, the new deputy chief of mission, had just arrived at the American embassy, where he'd been sent to replace Kurt Moore. The embassy staff was in a state of shock. The fate of their superior officers hung in the balance. But the mission of the U.S. State Department was unwavering. Diplomacy must go on. Khartoum was a lawless town, fueled by anti-American sentiment. And this was a fact every Foreign Service officer knew and accepted. Islamists were fighting Marxists and tribal warlords in the streets. There had been 2 bloody coups in 4 years. This majority Arab nation had severed all diplomatic relations with the United States after the 1967 Six-Day War, and only recently had relations been rekindled, largely due to the diplomatic efforts of Kurt Moore. Now he was being held at gunpoint inside the Saudi embassy, along with Cleo Noel and Guy Eade. As deputy chief of mission, Fritz recalled the devastation he felt trying to bring order to the chaos he was walking into. The embassy occupied the upper floors of a commercial office building adjoined by others on the main street, he recalled. An intense dust storm called a haboob had kicked up and the power was out. Dust and grit were everywhere, in your eyes and teeth. I climbed 5 or 6 floors up the back steps, carrying my suitcase and my garment bag over my shoulder. Fritz made his way through the darkness into the embassy, where he caught sight of Sandy Sanderson, an administrative officer, standing in the dim light with his glasses on a string around his neck. "I couldn't quite see his face," says Fritz. "He was backlighted by the emergency lamps, but I could tell he was crying." "We heard there was gunfire in the Saudi embassy," Sanderson sobbed. "They may be dead. You're in charge." Sandy Sanderson was right. Moments before their death, Eid, Moore, and Noel were allowed to write letters to their wives. "Cleo and I will die bravely and without tears, as men should," was the last sentence Kurt Moore wrote. These were not bullet-to-the-head assassinations. The men, blindfolded with their hands bound, were peppered with gunfire, starting at the ankles, with a barrage of bullets leading up to the head. Sadism was Black September's trademark, and its members were notorious for inflicting the maximum amount of pain and suffering on their victims. For Black September, assassination was about revenge, about righting a wrong, the theft of the Palestinian homeland by the Jews. Documents kept classified for decades reveal the Black September gunmen were told by their handler that Kurt Moore was the CIA's top man in the Middle East, that he worked for the Israelis and had personally directed the killing of Palestinians, none of which is known to be accurate. But perhaps the most chilling details of the tragedy are tethered to the United States, in particular to Henry Kissinger. Behind many hidden hand operations lie secret deals and dark bargains. Just days before the assassinations in Khartoum, an NSA listening post in Cyprus picked up a radio transmission indicating that a Black September operation was about to be carried out. The exhibits arrive on the Egyptian plane Wednesday morning, a man in the PLO's Beirut headquarters told a colleague in the Khartoum office, deciphered as code for a coming attack. The exhibits, the State Department later confirmed, were 7 gunmen from Black September, 4 disassembled AK-47s, and 8 hand grenades, all of which arrived on an Egyptian Air flight from Cairo on February 28th, the day before the killings. Why the State Department failed to properly warn its top diplomats in Khartoum of a suspected imminent attack would take decades to come to light. Although it was not known in 1973, Black September was the brainchild of Yasser Arafat, chairman of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, PLO. That the Black September terrorists took direct orders from Arafat, who planned and ordered the murder of the 2 American diplomats in Khartoum, was known only to a select few presidential advisors at the time. This information was kept classified by the State Department until 2006, until after Arafat, by then a Nobel Peace Prize recipient, had died. Bruce Hoffman, one of the world's foremost experts on terrorist organizations, explains. Black September had been formed as a deniable and completely covert special operations unit of the PLO group Al-Fatah by Arafat and his closest lieutenants, Hoffman says. Its fighters were assigned hardcore terrorist operations that included bombings, ambushes, hijackings, kidnappings, and assassinations. It was the most elite unit we had, one of Al-Fatah's former commanding generals told Hoffman. Our members were suicidal, not in the sense of religious terrorists who surrender their lives to ascend to heaven, but in the sense that we could send them anywhere to do anything, and they were prepared to lay down their lives to do it. No question, no hesitation. Black September's original mission was to foment regional violence and provoke Israel into bloody engagements, forcing its Arab neighbors from a passive to an active stance in its anti-Israel, anti-West campaign of violence. How Black September and the PLO worked together in secret is its own complex narrative. What is important to this story is that Arafat chose a man of contradictions, Ali Hassan Salameh, to serve as commander of the Special Operations Unit. Salameh was the son of the martyred Sheikh Hassan Salameh, commander of the Palestinian Holy War Army in the war against Israel, who died in battle in June 1948. But unlike his pious father, he was a playboy who drove around Beirut in expensive cars, ate at fancy restaurants, and dated models. Married with two sons, he flaunted his girlfriend around town. She was a former Miss Universe named Georgina Ritzk. Mossad gave him the insulting code name, the Red Prince. The terrorist organization took its name from the so-called Black September conflict. In September of 1970, Arafat's guerrilla warfare corps hijacked four international airplanes and forced them to land in the Jordanian desert at Dawson's Field. Jordan's King Hussein used his army against the terrorist group, expelling all members from the kingdom. In revenge, Yasser Arafat secretly ordered the Red Prince to oversee the assassination of Wasfi al-Tal, Jordan's prime minister, during the Arab League summit in Egypt the following year. As Tal entered the foyer of the Sheraton Cairo Hotel, a Black September gunman stepped forward and shot him in the chest at point-blank range. "They've killed me," Tal cried out as he fell to the floor bleeding. "Murderers! They believe only in fire and destruction." As Jordan's prime minister lay dying on the floor, the assassin got down on his hands and knees and licked the blood flowing across the marble floor. This was exactly the image of his Black September killers that Arafat wanted to portray, while keeping his hidden hand role secret from the world. The Times of London ran a photograph of this blood-licking act, an image that was reprinted in newspapers around the world. What Arafat also wanted, at least initially, was American passivity. As the United States withdrew its forces from Vietnam, Arab terrorist organizations started cropping up across the Middle East, inspired by the U.S. military's inability to defeat a much smaller guerrilla army. "Create two, three, many Vietnams," Che Guevara had instructed his fellow revolutionaries around the world, calling the Middle East a volcano threatening eruption in the world today. Even after his death, Che Guevara's words lived on. After successfully killing the Prime Minister of Jordan in 1972, Yasser Arafat endorsed the massacre of Israeli athletes at the Munich Summer Olympics, with operational command assigned to Ali Hassan Salameh. 11 Israeli Olympic team members were murdered sadistically. One of the Olympians, weightlifter Yosef Romano, was castrated as his teammates looked on. Others were beaten and burned to death. Israel kept the most horrific details hidden from the public, knowing that this kind of violence opened the door to copycat operations. In response to the Munich massacre, Israeli intelligence launched Operation Wrath of God, with the goal of killing every Black September member involved. Immediately following World War II, before the Nuremberg trials and other forms of procedural justice addressed the killing of millions of Jews, a small group of Holocaust survivors tracked down Nazi war criminals for assassination. They called themselves Nakam, Hebrew for Avengers. The group used an underground intelligence network to learn where individual Nazis lived so that they could kill them. These assassinations were rarely reported in the media because what country wanted the notoriety that came with a revelation that it had been harboring a Nazi war criminal? After Israel became a nation state, a program of revenge killing was refined and developed by Mossad, Israel's equivalent of the CIA, which was founded in December 1949. Soon, in certain situations, assassination would be Mossad's weapon of choice. Mossad's assassination program was officially classified, but unofficially it was an open secret. The logic was, if you don't punish for one crime, you will get another, says Dina Porat, chief historian at Israel's Yad Vashem, or Holocaust Memorial. This is what was driving the Avengers, not only justice, but a warning. A warning to the world that you cannot hurt Jews in such a manner and get away with it. In its first two decades of statehood, Mossad became the undisputed masters of assassination, overtaking even the KGB in ruthlessness, cunning, and effectiveness. The department inside Mossad responsible for assassination was named Caesarea, after the ancient Roman city built by Herod the Great. And inside Caesarea, there was an even more secret, more elite assassination unit called Kidon, Hebrew for bayonet. After Black September murdered the 11 Israeli athletes in Munich, Mossad unleashed Kidon on them. Mossad's targeted assassinations of Black September operatives were equally brutal. This, too, was revenge. Wael Zwider was shot 11 times at close range, allegedly one bullet for each murdered Israeli athlete, in his Rome apartment. Mahmoud Hamshari was blown up in his Paris home after a bomb hidden inside his telephone receiver was detonated by Israeli assassins from across the street. A Black September operative in London was expertly pushed under a fast-moving bus. More than a dozen Operation Wrath of God murders followed, including that of an innocent man named Ahmed Bukili in Lillehammer, Norway, a case of mistaken identity. Kidon operatives believed that the Norwegian waiter was the Red Prince. As the cycle of violence escalated, Black September fought back with a plan to assassinate Israel's Prime Minister, Golda Meir, during a visit with Pope Paul VI. Relations between Israel and the Vatican had been strained since Israel's founding. Mossad legend has it that in 1948, in exchange for diplomatic relations, the Vatican asked Israel to hold a mock trial of Jesus and reverse the original biblical death verdict of Christ. Israel declined, and no prime minister had been invited to the Vatican since. Golda Meir was not about to cancel this historic trip because of a death threat by Black September. In Rome, Mossad learned that the Red Prince intended to shoot down Meir's airplane with Russian-made SA-7 guided missiles as it landed at Rome's Leonardo da Vinci Airport. Using a network of sleeper agents, Mossad disrupted the plot with just minutes to spare, according to sources familiar with the case. After failing to kill Golda Meir in Rome, Yasser Arafat assigned the Red Prince an even more incendiary job: oversee the assassination of two U.S. diplomats in Khartoum, Sudan. the cold-blooded, in plain sight assassinations of American diplomats inside another sovereign nation's embassy in Khartoum demanded a formidable response. Except most Americans had zero appetite for getting involved in terrorist disputes overseas. 591 American POWs held in North Vietnam were still in the process of being brought home from Hanoi. Diplomacy with armed revolutionaries did not work. Military force was not an option. The stage was set to handle the situation with the president's third option, the hidden hand. After the Black September terrorists killed Kurt Moore, Noel Cleo, and Guy Eade in the basement of the Saudi Arabian embassy in Khartoum, the killers called their PLO commander in Beirut and asked what to do next. Yasser Arafat instructed them to surrender to Sudanese authorities. "Your mission has ended," Arafat said in a communication that was intercepted by Mossad and shared with Henry Kissinger, but which the State Department kept secret until 2006. "Explain your just cause to the great Sudanese masses and international opinion. We are with you on the same road," Arafat said. The next morning, the eight gunmen surrendered themselves. Two were released, and the remaining six tried for murder. During the trial, the leader of the group said that they'd acted under the orders of the Palestine Liberation Organization and should only be questioned by that organization. The assassins were convicted by a Sudanese court, but just a few hours later, President Numeri commuted their sentences and put them on a plane to Cairo, where they were turned over to the PLO. When pressed by the State Department, President Numeri defended his actions by saying that other states handed over Palestinian terrorists after far less action, and that America needed to face the political facts of life. President Numeri said that he had Sudanese and Arab opinion to consider. 3 decades later, in June 2006, the State Department quietly posted online a 1973 CIA summary of the assassinations in Khartoum. The Khartoum operation was carried out with the full knowledge and personal approval of Yasser Arafat, chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization, it stated. Robert Fritz recalled the fallout at the U.S. Embassy in Khartoum. "The embassy staff was shattered, absolutely shattered. The U.S. government pressured the Egyptians not to release them. They were put under loose house arrest in a Nile mansion. Eventually, they evaporated, tacitly allowed to disappear." "It was a travesty," lamented Fritz. Henry Kissinger was cited as having a bigger picture in mind. The bigger picture Henry Kissinger had in mind was dark and complex. In late 1973, in addition to serving as the president's national security advisor, Kissinger was now Secretary of State, meaning he was at the top of the chain of command of all U.S. diplomats. Instead of bringing the killers to justice, the better play, Kissinger decided, was to make a deal with Yasser Arafat and to use the Red Prince, Ali Hassan Salameh, as a clandestine asset. At the CIA, the plan had been 3 years in the making. It began with a CIA case officer, an expert on Middle East affairs named Robert Ames. Salameh and Ames were like two sides of a coin. Ames, 35, looked like an insurance salesman with his 1950s haircut and wide tie. A devoted husband and father of five, Bob Ames was frugal, rarely drank, and sported a small pot belly. Salameh roamed around Beirut in open shirts with chest hair spilling out, his playboy reputation preceding him. A fourth-degree black belt, the Red Prince chain-smoked, drank expensive scotch, listened to Elvis Presley, and worked out regularly in the Continental Hotel gym. The cryptonym Bob Ames chose for Salome was MJ Trust, too. MJ was the code for Palestinians, PLO. Ames allegedly chose the root word trust because he trusted Salome. The number two designated him as the second CIA asset in a cluster. MJ Trust One was Yasser Arafat. Perhaps it is impossible to understand how and why Bob Ames chose to trust a man who'd orchestrated the murder of 11 Israeli athletes in Munich and two U.S. diplomats and a Belgian in Sudan, plus scores of others. But what is clear is that by 1974, Bob Ames's relationship with Salome had warped. Ames had overstepped the unwritten case officer asset rules in dangerous ways. In a letter to his wife, Yvonne, Ames called Salome his important friend. The two men exchanged gifts. After Salome gave Ames a set of golden prayer beads, Ames wanted to give his friend a gift of equal significance. Salome walked around Beirut with a pistol on his right hip. Beirut's Al-Safar newspaper published photographs of him like this, and Ames thought it would be a great idea to give Salome a gun as a gift. Before he did, he sought approval from CIA headquarters. His superior, CIA Director Richard Helms, expressed outrage. "This crossed some invisible line," writes Ames's biographer Kai Bird. "The agency could have dealings with a terrorist, but it would be unseemly to make a gift of a gun." Ames wouldn't give up, says his former analyst colleague Bruce Rydell, so headquarters suggested a compromise. They told Ames, "Okay, why don't you give him a replica of a gun?" Ames, insulted, rejected the idea. Former CIA case officer Henry Miller Jones has an interesting take. "They tell you in the CIA never to fall in love with your agent, but everyone does." For a while, the arrangement between the CIA and Ali Hassan Salome suited the CIA. That arrangement was to now leave U.S. diplomats and CIA officers out of the Black September bullseye. The Red Prince wrote and signed a non-assassination guarantee for all U.S. diplomats in Lebanon, wrote British journalist Gordon Thomas. In Beirut's intelligence circles, the joke was, "It pays to live in the same building as American diplomats because the PLO security is so good." But the arrangement would only last as long as Salome was alive, and Mossad had every intention of assassinating the Red Prince. It would take a covert team of Mossad assassins 5 years to kill Salome, with a car bomb exploded on a Beirut street on January 22, 1979. Four of his bodyguards and three innocent passers-by were also killed in the targeted assassination. Before Salome was blown up, Bob Ames was able to give him the ultimate gift he longed for, a trip to the United States. With a CIA handler driving Salome around, the Black September operations chief and his new bride, Georgina Ritzk, visited CIA offices in Virginia, Hawaii, New Orleans, and California, where they also visited Disneyland. The agency handler, codenamed Charles Waverly, went out of his way to make Salome comfortable, going so far as to teach the Red Prince how to eat oysters and scuba dive. His January 1979 assassination was a turning point in the Middle East for the CIA and would impact U.S. national security for decades to come. 20,000 people, including Yasser Arafat, attended Salome's funeral. Why did Henry Kissinger, as Secretary of State, encourage the CIA's use of Ali Hassan Salome, a known terrorist, as an ally? Why choose covert action, the president's third option, over diplomacy, the first? This decision likely had to do with Kissinger's proximity to a series of scandalous events that were unfolding in Washington, D.C. In the spring of 1973, Congress began investigating what would become known as Watergate. For the first time in its history, the CIA allowed investigators from Congress to review documents from its files and interview its employees, says former CIA Inspector General L. Britt Snyder. As it turned out, all five of the men arrested for burglarizing the offices of the Democratic National Committee at the Watergate Hotel in June 1972 had connections with the CIA. Here began a series of events and missteps within the CIA that would bring the agency to the most dramatic turning point in its history. It was the closest the agency has ever come to being disbanded. Nixon's CIA director, James Schlesinger, was preparing to leave the agency to become Secretary of Defense. Before he left, Schlesinger sent a memo to all CIA employees ordering them to reveal to him any illegal activity they might have been involved in since the agency's creation 25 years before. The instruction prompted a flurry of written reports, which were then compiled into a 700-page document that would become known as the Family Jewels. The action was unprecedented. The CIA had never compiled its hidden hand operations before. 3 weeks later, the New York Times broke a story revealing that Kissinger had authorized the FBI and the CIA to illegally wiretap reporters, White House officials, and even his own National Security Council staff. Mindful that a major scandal was brewing in Washington, D.C., the CIA's new director, William Colby, felt the best move was to lock the family jewels inside the safe in his office. Over the next 15 months, the Watergate scandal, about a different illegal wiretapping, consumed the news media and the public. The family jewels remained locked in Colby's safe. On August 8, 1974, President Nixon resigned, and Vice President Gerald Ford assumed the presidency. But the press was unrelenting, and the focus now swung to yet another CIA scandal that had previously remained hidden, raising alarms across the Ford White House. In December 1974, Colby, who had run the Phoenix program in Vietnam, sent Kissinger a note explaining some of the contents of the family jewels. Kissinger drafted a 5-page memorandum for the president, summarizing the contents of what was there. Some of the actions clearly were illegal, Kissinger said. Others raise profound moral questions. The most incendiary material covered the CIA's role in the assassination of foreign leaders, Kissinger warned. He said that if these revelations became public, the CIA would be destroyed. It was a stunning concept that the CIA could actually be considered expendable. President Ford met with his chief of staff, Donald Rumsfeld, and his deputy chief of staff, Dick Cheney, to discuss the next move. They decided to invite editors from the New York Times to the White House for a discussion in the spirit of transparency. During a luncheon at the White House on January 16, 1975, New York Times reporters asked President Ford why the family jewels was not going to be declassified. Ford blundered. It contained explosive material that would blacken the eye of every president since Truman, Ford said defensively. Like what? One of the editors asked. Like assassination, answered Ford. Everyone went silent. The comment was made off the record, the president insisted, but it was too late. The cat was out of the bag. CBS News reported the bombshell. President Ford has reportedly warned associates that if the current Family Jewels investigations goes too far, they could uncover several assassinations of foreign officials involving the CIA. Across the nation and in Congress, there was uproar, moral outrage. The White House vowed to create a commission to investigate, ultimately turning the matter over to Congress. Starting in the spring of 1975, the Senate Select Committee to Study Governmental Operations with Respect to Intelligence Activities, chaired by Idaho Senator Frank Church, held 60 days of closed hearings. 75 witnesses were called to the stand, including many of the most senior officers at the CIA. Among the findings, the Church Committee learned that the CIA had conducted more than 900 major projects and several thousand smaller operations, three-quarters of which had never been reviewed outside the agency. The assassination plots against Rafael Trujillo, Fidel Castro, the Diem brothers, and others were made public for the first time. Senator Church called the CIA a rogue elephant raging out of control. Exotic weapons used in assassination plots were shown on TV, including a gun that shot poison darts. The investigation lasted 6 months. That the CIA even had a paramilitary capacity shocked most Americans. That it engaged in plans to assassinate foreign leaders was perceived as morally outrageous. But what's notable is how blame fell almost entirely on the CIA when a comprehensive read makes clear that the orders were coming from the Office of the President. The House Select Committee had its own investigation going on, chaired by Otis Pike, a Democrat from New York. The Pike Committee interviewed many of the same individuals as the Church Committee and found that the White House was to blame, far more so than the CIA. The CIA does not go galloping off conducting operations by itself, Congressman Pike wrote. The major things which are done are not done unilaterally by the CIA without approval from higher up the line. We did find evidence upon evidence upon evidence where the CIA said, no, don't do it. The State Department or the White House said, we're going to do it. The CIA was much more professional and had a far deeper reading on the down-the-road implications of some immediately popular act than the executive branch or administration officials. The CIA never did anything the White House didn't want. Sometimes they didn't want to do what they did. As the committees prepared to release their reports, there was a stunning move from the White House. President Ford met with his advisors, Rumsfeld and Cheney, who told him the reports had to be suppressed. Any document which officially shows American involvement in assassination is clearly a foreign policy disaster, Rumsfeld said. We are better off with a political confrontation than a legal one. Dick Cheney advised him that the White House should object to the release and attempt to block the reports on grounds that it compromised national security. President Ford agreed. A new team of presidential advisors was needed, Rumsfeld told the president, leading Ford to dismiss several key members of his cabinet. Schlesinger was let go as Secretary of Defense, replaced by Rumsfeld. Cheney became White House Chief of Staff. CIA Director William Colby was replaced by George H.W. Bush. Henry Kissinger retained his position as Secretary of State, but was replaced by Brent Scowcroft in the role of National Security Advisor. Later, Ford expressed regret for taking these actions. I was angry at myself for showing cowardice in not saying no to the ultra-conservatives, he said. It was the biggest political mistake of my life, and it was one of the few cowardly things I did in my life. Despite considerable efforts, Ford's new team of advisors failed to keep the Church Committee report classified, with Congress asserting its right to override the president. The Church Committee report, alleged assassination plots involving foreign leaders, was released in November of 1975. In a note all but lost to history, the Ford White House was able to suppress the Pike report. Months later, parts of it were leaked to the Village Voice. But the public's mind was already made up. The CIA, not the White House, was to blame. In undated notes located in files at the Gerald Ford Presidential Library, Dick Cheney advised President Ford on the imperative to restore the authority of the executive branch. It had been unduly diminished by Congress in the wake of the Watergate scandal, Cheney said, and by the congressional reports. The advice was significant, as it foreshadowed Cheney's own use of presidential authority 26 years later when he served as vice president. As vice president, Cheney would participate in presidential findings and MONs that dictated covert action, says John Rizzo, the CIA's long-serving clandestine service legal officer, in an interview for this book. As vice president in the George W. Bush White House, Dick Cheney served in the inner circle of presidential advisors and was present at most covert action meetings, Rizzo clarifies, not something you usually saw from a vice president. Rizzo was hired at the CIA in 1976 and served seven presidents, including as the CIA's top lawyer during the War on Terror. The remarkable construct of presidential authority, says Rizzo, is that the President of the United States can listen to whomever he wants. The year after the Church Committee published its report, President Ford issued Executive Order 11905, a decree to govern covert action operations, and this included a prohibition on assassinations. No employee of the United States government shall engage in or conspire to engage in political assassination, it read. Senator Frank Church objected, stating that a presidential decree could easily be changed by decree by another president, that by having an executive order on assassination and not a new law passed by Congress, the door was left wide open for new liberties in interpretation when a more conservative president took the helm, which is exactly what happened in 1981 when President Ronald Reagan and his advisors began exploring a new executive order allowing for preemptive neutralization of people who wanted to harm the United States. As Americans were reading the Church Committee report, learning about the dark underbelly of hidden hand operations and rogue actors, one of the most outrageous hostage-taking events of the 20th century unfolded halfway across the world in Vienna, Austria. On December 21, 1975, the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, was holding a conference of ministers at its headquarters in the Texaco building on Dr. Karl Luger Ring when six individuals, five men and a woman, casually walked up to the guard at the front desk and asked to be directed to the proceedings. They looked reasonable enough, wearing raincoats and carrying gym bags. At least one from the group spoke German. But then, reaching into their bags, they pulled out submachine guns and began shooting, killing three people. The gunmen stormed the OPEC conference hall and corralled 60 people as hostages, including 10 of the world's 11 oil ministers, whose countries controlled 80% of the world's oil. Never before, and not since, have so many government officials from so many different nations been taken hostage all at once. Austria's head of state, Chancellor Bruno Kreisky, was out skiing in the Alps. When he learned the news from his ministers, he rushed back to Vienna to deal with this first-of-its-kind crisis. In a press conference, Kreisky said that his government did not know who the terrorists were and that their organizational demands were not clear. As chancellor, however, he had granted the terrorists permission to fly out of the country with the 10 oil ministers and others as hostages. Kreisky neglected to say that he'd negotiated the release of the Austrian hostages in exchange for meeting the terrorists' demands. In hindsight, this course of action appears absurd, but in 1975, Austria, like most other nations, was unequipped to deal with a hostage crisis. We were pressured into this decision by the fear that the hostages' lives would be taken, Chancellor Kreisky later said. You cannot stamp out terrorism by retaliation, because terrorism has its own laws. At 7 a.m. the following morning, 41 hostages were loaded onto a municipal bus, driven to the airport, and flown to Algeria, North Africa, in an Austrian Airlines DC-9 with a volunteer crew. At a second press conference, an Iraqi man acting as an intermediary said that the hostage takers called themselves the Arm of the Arab Revolution, and that their leader went by the nom de guerre Carlos the Jackal. His real name was Ilich Ramirez Sanchez. He was a 25-year-old terrorist and assassin for hire. Born into a wealthy family in Venezuela, Ilich Ramirez Sanchez was sent by his Marxist father to Moscow to study at the Patrice Lumumba University, a breeding ground for a wide variety of terrorists in training. After getting expelled for reasons unknown, he transformed himself into Carlos the Jackal, hiring himself out to Arab terrorist organizations like Black September. By the time of the OPEC siege, the Venezuelan-born terrorist had killed at least 7 people and was wanted by the British, French, and Israeli intelligence services. In Algiers, Ilich Ramirez Sanchez met privately with President Houari Boumediene, and an agreement was reached. 5 oil ministers and 31 hostages were released, while 5 oil ministers and 10 civilians would be kept as hostages. The aircraft left Algeria, this time headed for Tripoli, Libya. Here, he met privately with President Muammar Gaddafi, and a secret agreement was reached. After this meeting, Ilich Ramirez Sanchez returned to the aircraft and instructed the pilots to fly back to Algiers, where the remaining 5 oil ministers and 10 hostages were freed. He met with Boumediene a second time, flew to Baghdad, and vanished for more than a decade. It was later revealed that in Libya, he'd been paid $50 million in cash. Instead of sharing the money with his revolutionary comrades, he kept the money for himself. He would live off the cash as Carlos the Jackal for the next 18 years. The CIA now had a watchful eye on Libya and on Muammar Gaddafi, and a list of questions it wanted answered. Who was this man who called himself Carlos the Jackal, and where was Arab terrorism headed next? Would non-Palestinians like Ilich Ramirez Sanchez remain committed to the Palestinian cause if there weren't millions of dollars to be made? To learn the answer to these questions would require covert operations, But for now, the CIA's hands were tied. Alternative options needed to be explored, and they would be.